Welcome to Helpful Social Work. Social work has the power to change people's lives for the better. This podcast aims to help you learn, think, and act with integrity so that people who need social work get help that will transform their lives. I'm Jerry.
And I'm Jo. And this is podcast 6A from series 3. Last podcast, we talked about the good life, following on from our discussion about planning. And we really hope you enjoy the podcast. Let us know what you think by visiting our website, www.helpfulsocialwork.com, or by commenting on iTunes. We look forward to hearing from you.
And if we can edit it out with our wizardry from Sterling, our colleague Kevin will take out the dog in the background. But if not, that was Lola. And I just wanted to say that we've just passed 20,000 downloads for Helpful Social Work, which is wonderful. It's around 400 listens per episode. And interestingly, Jo, our most popular episode remains 1A from series 1 on integrity. And I think that isn't because it's gone downhill from there. I think it's genuinely because integrity is the most important thing that we've talked about.
Yes, let's hope it's the latter and not the former. And I'm sure everyone will forgive us Lola's little a request to be let out.
And in the UK, I had a look at where people are listening, and most listens are in London, which is supposed fits with the population, and then Hartford, Cambridgeshire, Bristol, Manchester and Norfolk within England. So that's quite good.
That is a nice spread, isn't it? Good. Yeah, wouldn't it be lovely? It'd be lovely to hear from you guys.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about funding today as part of our journey through social work. And we've just talked about assessment and planning, and inevitably there follows the question of money. Whatever we want to do, you have to consider how you're going to resource it. So social work is really intimately connected with money.
Well, in fact, Jerry, I think that we're redistributors. We're part of the way society reorganises its wealth from one section of the population to another. And to start with a quote this time, we're like the Lorax. We speak for the trees, or we speak for people who often don't have a powerful enough voice in the society they're living in to affect that redistribution by themselves.
Yeah, and we thought it might be interesting to start by talking about how within social work we kind of maybe had a journey of realization about money and funding and the implications of it. So I'll start by saying that I grew up thinking that the welfare state would provide. And when I became a social work student, I realized that actually there's some real barriers to the welfare state providing. I did a dissertation around access to attendance allowance for people end of life, which you should automatically get under special rules, but actually many people are missing out on. And then when I became a social worker, obviously realised the finite nature, the really finite nature of welfare money and what we can actually provide. And as I kind of became a team manager and a service manager, found myself increasingly worried about budgets. And since I've moved more into practice improvement and into kind of more national policy work and advocacy work for social work, really coming to what you've said about, you know, our role in advocating for redistribution and transparency and public understanding about what money is actually available and that it isn't enough.
Yep. And I think for me, my experience was more personal in a way. I grew up in a family where there were lots of issues around money and poverty. So I was always keenly aware of the role of government in providing opportunity for some people. I went to university on a scholarship, which paid for my living expenses. And that chance for me to go to university depended on the scholarship, because with all the best will in the world, my parents absolutely could not have sent me. And I grew up, I got involved early in advocating for the rights of people with disability. And at the time, they were seen of kind of, you know, the Cinderella of the social care funding world. We worked in a small government-funded community respite facility that depended a lot on goodwill and the ability to write a good funding application. So I kind of understood the tensions between what it was that people needed to live a life of dignity and value, and the value that was being put on their life by society and by government funding, and they didn't always seem to match up. And like you, the further up you go in management, the more you start to understand, well, there's a pot, isn't there? You know, there is funding there, but it's got to do lots of things. And so there's real tension.
Yeah, so I think the first thing we'd say is that there's a tension between our role working with an individual and our awareness of the population needs. And that all social workers do have this really powerful role around redistribution and advocating for redistribution. I also wanted to mention a couple of definitions just because I'm interested in where these words have come from. So fund comes from the Latin fundus, meaning the foundation or the bottom, which kind of suggests that money is actually kind of at the root of what we're doing. And then resource, it's got a wonderful kind of background. It comes from Latin resurgere, meaning to rise again, which is actually also really wonderful, isn't it? If you think about resources, something that will help people rise up.
And rise again is interesting, isn't it? So that idea of, you know, that it actually can, if you do sink down, there's an acknowledgement that it can pull you up again. Yeah. And I think that's right. I think resources is what enables us to navigate our way successfully in this world. And when I think of money, sorry, Jerry, I just wanted to say, you know, that historically money it's an invention, isn't it, that allowed us to carry our wealth around more easily. It's really hard to fit a cow in your pocket, for example. So, you know, people used shells or used other things to say, this is how many I've got. If you bring this back, you can have this. And money is still really tied to that idea. Mm-hmm. But resources is much wider than that, in my mind. A much wider thing than just money.
Yes, I think there's a few implications there for social workers around, first of all, thinking of ourselves as a resource and as a way of helping people rise up. Secondly, recognising the implications of people having or not having resources and how they get treated and seen and viewed within society. Mm. And the other is kind of recognising the impact of inequality just in terms of the material stuff. You know, some people, I was looking at some research, very recent research on poverty and inequality from the Institute for Fiscal Studies. And one in four poor children live in the 10% most deprived local authorities.
Yeah.
And low income is most likely to be persistent for pensioners, lone parents and those with more than three children. So there's some really important things around not just the amount of poverty, but the concentration of it. And the lack of resources being concentrated in particular groups.
And I think also, Jerry, that kind of comes to that idea too, that when you experience actual poverty like that, the other thing, if we think about this idea of rise again, the other thing that often happens is the poverty of hope. So there's a real impact on how hopeful you feel and how resourceful you feel as a person if you're one of those children living in one of the 10 most deprived local authorities.
Yeah. And I guess there's a knock-on effect on the hope of the social workers working in those areas as well.
Yeah.
So I think the first job that we have after we've recognised this stuff is to help people maximise income, which is getting harder because what the welfare state provides is reducing in our country anyway. Acknowledging that as part of the role. And I think one of the tensions that we have is that very often social workers aren't given the time or the recognition that is part of our role, that is really crucial. And we're expected maybe to not do anything about it at all, or where we are to do something about it is to signpost to other agencies that might help with kind of maximising benefits or advising on finance. Mm. And those agencies are also under pressure. Because they're often voluntary sector agencies that may be having their funding reduced or have got an overwhelming demand.
I think it's interesting when you talk about, you know, us as a profession not being given that space. But sometimes I think it's even more than that, because with all the funding panels and the resource panels that are being set up that social workers have to go to. So now when a social worker writes a plan, if that plan has resources that require funding, then they have to go to a panel to argue that case. And one of the things that happens sometimes for social workers, I was reading this in Community Care actually, where social workers say that they feel like they're not trusted either, like they can't make that decision for the individual. And of course, as a manager, as a senior manager, you can understand why with the funding for local authorities being squeezed and squeezed, there's got to be so much scrutiny and so much management of that pot. But you can see the knock-on effect for the social worker trying to deal with the individual. And for me, it's like, you know, how do we prioritize funding decisions? How much investment do we need to put into our young people to gain a contributing adult? How much investment do we need to put into health to ensure we keep our contributing workforce healthy? How much into old age to ensure a comfortable and dignified passing? You know, what, somebody somewhere is making judgments around these types of questions.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, there is a context. So there's a wide context of funding reducing across all areas of the public sector. And that being a social issue, a social justice issue initially in terms of redistribution and people getting access to services that they need, but also a social justice issue in terms of the kind of medium and longer term, where we can say that if people are not being able to thrive now and therefore to contribute in the future, we will get an increase in kind of poverty of contribution. But the other thing is the kind of immediate social work environment, where you have somebody who requires funding for sort of set, you know, to meet needs and achieve outcomes that you've identified. You made a professional judgment about what that should look like, and saying, you know, amongst the various options that might be available, sometimes they aren't, this is what would be sufficient. And certainly in adult services, we use the kind of term sufficiency in the Care Act guidance. And then that gets scrutinised, and whether that scrutiny is adding something to it, to the decision or not. Because ideally what you'd have is a professional judgment that says this is what would be sufficient, and then that is honoured by the organisation with some appropriate checks, which would be more about adding to the judgment, saying that's great that you've made that individual judgment. We've got oversight of a bigger picture. There may be some things you haven't thought of, but once that bit's done, saying, yeah, okay, that's sufficient. And I suppose there's a concern, isn't there, that the checks aren't about making sure that you're getting the right thing in place. They're about trying to cut costs.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. It's about the emphasis. And what you're saying there, I really like that way of thinking. You know, is this sufficient for this person to have enough comfort and dignity and security that they are able to rise again, I guess, if you want to think about it that way, that you're able to be an active and contributing part of the society that you're in, and that you feel like that, you feel like you belong. And that's not about, to my mind, you know, giving handouts or giving people something for nothing, all the things that are popularly feared. You know, if you talk about redistribution, often the people who pay kind of bring up this idea that somebody's getting a free ride, you know, someone's getting a free ride, and they'll talk about whether it be single mothers or whether it be, you know, those mythical people who get X amount of money that some amount you've never heard of. There's always someone taking more, isn't there? But I don't think that's what it's about. It's about trying to find a way that we all feel part of society and feel valued in society, and money's got to form a part of that.
Yes. So the sufficiency of resource isn't just what you need right now to survive. It's also what you need to thrive and achieve outcomes, because we're trying to think medium and long term. One of the things that concerns me, particularly in children's services, is you might be thinking just to the point when the person's 18 and then there's a cliff edge kind of issue.
Yeah.
And also we're thinking about the dignity and the contribution of that person and preventative work as well. So there's a lot that a social worker can consider and can use the law and policy to consider that will say, and this is why we need funding and this is what would be sufficient. And I think that is our role, although there then is a public sector role about managing budgets, isn't there? And that's where we have to have the most constructive dialogue that we can, I think, with the budget holder.
Mm. And I was saying to you that we need sustainable redistribution. You know, I've kind of done this little drawing where I've tried to work out, well, you know, how do we get a system that's in balance, a system where what we contribute and what we draw out is balanced so that nobody feels as if it's unfair, I guess, in any way. And to me, you know, we spend a lot of time drawing out of the system, and I worked out that overall we have about 38 years of our life where we draw out of the system and 47 years where we contribute overall. But we're drawing out the whole time, aren't we? We're drawing out for roads, public infrastructure, health, rebates, transport. All of us are taking from the system and all of us are contributing to it. And I think what we want is a state funding that actually ensures the most vulnerable people in our society have protection, and that drawing in and drawing out balances itself.
Yeah. One of the things that's helpful about thinking of it in those terms is also that then there isn't a unique category of people who need stuff from the state.
No, we all take it.
We all do. Yeah. So it's part of the human condition to receive and to give. And so some of the sort of rhetoric and unhelpful discussions about people who require funding right now for whatever reason actually get completely undermined by the idea that actually none of us is completely independent. We're all interdependent and we're all needing some help at some time and contributing at some time. And the very narrow view of kind of economic contribution of, you know, are you a wage earner paying tax, is nothing like comprehensive enough to capture the sorts of contributions that people really make.
Absolutely. You know, and we know, and that, I guess that's what David Cameron was trying to do with his big society idea, when he was trying to encourage people, you know, to see themselves as a resource in their society and you know, encouraging us to reconnect. But all that is part of social work, isn't it? Is making sure that all our resources are being used and offered.
Yeah, and this is where I wanted to mention actually strength-based practice in adult services, which will have its parallels in children's services. But this idea that you look at the resources that a person has themselves, the kind of capabilities that they have, the expertise and the strengths, and also what's in their network and their community. And I think that's really valuable in thinking about resource not just being what we offer, but what people can bring to it themselves. But I do also think that has to go hand in hand with anti-oppressive practice, because the strengths that people are currently have and have access to, and their ability at any point to draw on those, will be affected by the history of how they've been treated and the kinds of barriers that they've experienced as they've gone along. So what we have to be really careful of to avoid doing is saying to someone, you have strengths, crack on, when there's been a whole history of people being undermined, really, by others, by personal and cultural and structural issues that have affected them. So we have to address those as well.
Yes. And it's getting that balance right, isn't it, Jerry? Because the thing is, if you are really preoccupied, genuinely preoccupied and frightened about where you will sleep tonight, how you will feed your children, whether you will be able to have enough money to get the bus to go to that health appointment or to go for a job interview, whether you'll be able to have a clean shirt to wear, all of those things. It's very hard to tap into your own strengths. Mm. And so part of that's why funding is so important in social work. We can't ignore the actual fact that some people do not have enough money to navigate or manage in our society, and that part of what we need to do is help them address that, because they're not going to rise again if that barrier can't be overcome, I don't think.
Yes, I think the growing emphasis on anti-poverty practice is really important here as well, because within, you know, there's been criticisms, haven't there, within various parts of social work, particularly I think around children's services assessment not fully recognising the impact of poverty.
Yep.
And certainly the adoption inquiry that BASWA did last year highlighted that, you know, poverty aware practice as being a really important element of making judgments about how parents are coping. So recognising the impact of that lack of resource and funding on people's lives, and making that clear in the assessment and the support planning that we're doing, and trying to get income where we can for people, and campaigning, yeah, I think, more widely for a decent income for people.
Absolutely. And I think it's not that strange that we find many of our cases of neglect come from areas where there's also huge amounts of poverty. Not that those two things are linked together. In other words, poor people, that sounds awful. But people who are suffering poverty don't, you know, neglect their children. That's not the correlation. The correlation is that poverty makes it really difficult for you to continue to manage to provide all the care that you would want to. So it is absolutely critical area that we should be talking about in every single assessment.
The other thing that I wanted to talk about is the impact of all of this work on social workers. So what we're essentially saying here, to try and summarise, is that you're asked to make a professional judgment about the resource from state funding and other areas that will be sufficient to help people thrive and achieve outcomes and have hopefully longer term success and contribution, and that will also have some sort of preventative element. You're trying to do that with an individual in a difficult context. You're also having to balance that kind of gate opening with the fact that you are a gatekeeper potentially for people who don't need things as much, and also trying to balance across the whole population. And the impact of that is quite profound, I think, on social workers. I think, you know, the judgments that we make, recognising the consequences of them for people, we make those judgments with people as much as possible, but some of that responsibility rests with you as a professional to give that opinion. And I think we just need to acknowledge that that can have a knock-on effect, and the support that is needed, and the opportunity to reflect on what that feels like with colleagues, with supervisors. Yeah,
it's that fine line, isn't it, between rescuing somebody and enabling them to live the life that they want to live, and knowing that sometimes you can't do either of those things because actually the funding and the resources aren't there to give them the complete leg up that you'll know they need. And so instead you do a little bit of what you can do, but you know that it's not enough actually, and you know that what's going to happen is that the lift will be a temporary thing, and that the minute those services are pulled out that there'll be that drop again. And I do think that that is very dispiriting. And I think that social workers often feel quite guilty about that inability to provide things, you know, that they can see people that would make people's lives genuinely better. It's a big job, isn't it? It's a big job being asked to. It goes back to that old Victorian system of the deserving poor. Do you remember that when part of what we did was not that I'm saying we remember that personally, Jerry. I hasten
not quite
to add,
that old, yeah.
Not being quite that old, but that idea that there were some parts, there were some people who deserved our help because of attributes they had, either moral characteristics or other characteristics that had been put on them by society that deemed them good enough to deserve help. And then there were people who were undeserving, who shouldn't get anything. And social work is kind of involved in that element of redistribution, isn't it? Making those decisions about who it is that genuinely needs help.
Well, we still have that rhetoric around, and some of it is not evidenced, but ideological. And that's where we have to be really, really careful. For our own kind of sake of our own, understanding our own prejudices, but also understanding the pressure that's exerted to push social services, public services into helping the right kind of people, for ideological reasons. So we need to really resist that, both within
Absolutely.
Ourselves, because we're some people we have more of an affinity with than others.
Yeah, of course we do.
And also, we do get. We do get that push from people around us, and make our decisions really on with finite resources on the basis of what is the evidenced best use for these resources that we have.
That's exactly right. How can we allocate them in the best way to make the most helpful difference?
And the last thing I wanted to say about that actually is where we can't do everything that we want to, which is just it's a function of social work, isn't it? Something that happens all the time. One of the things that really helps is transparency for children, adults and families. If you aren't able to offer the thing that the person wants or the thing that would be the best possible, or even the first 20 things on the list of what would be the best, being really transparent about why gives respect and an explanation to the person, something that they can kind of have to make sense of what's gone on. Because what you don't want is people feeling that they are at the whim of arbitrary decisions. And I think helps us, it helps us to make sense of what we've been able to do as well.
And I think there's something there, isn't it, about exploring that impact too, like having honest conversations with people about this is the resource that is there, what can you do with it? What can be done with it? What can be possible, made more possible with that? And what will be the impact of not having everything? Because we all go through that actually in our daily life, don't we? It's like me at the moment. I have got a house to renovate, and we have been able to get some money to do some of that work, but not everything that we would like. And so now we have to say, okay, well, with the pot we've got, how can we do the things that will make the most difference to us and help us have the best future? And that's that idea too of we picked up on this earlier in the conversation I wanted to say is we should be thinking about a person's whole life, no matter where we encounter them. This is becoming clearer and clearer to me as I'm doing this work in aged care at the moment, and I'm seeing people who appear to be almost surprised that they've got to their frailty years. Like people think that they will live forever, they won't get old, or we think children won't grow up, or I don't know what it is about us, but we need to have a lifespan look at funding and really be thinking the whole time about what will help people, what it is that we can offer people now that will give them that foundation to be able to continue to build and grow a healthy life for their whole life long.
Yeah, and for those people who are in services where they're making more strategic decisions, it's around how what we invest in social care and social work then impacts on other agencies and how we might pool things and pool effort. That does go for individual work as well, doesn't it? How you work with other agencies. And it's also something that any social worker can get active in terms of policy and trying to avoid sort of silos between different kinds of services. It does require that holistic and kind of lifespan look, doesn't it?
And working collaboratively with pooled budgets. I mean, I know that we've tried this time and time again, but it, to my mind, wouldn't it be great if we hadn't got a system where we were competing with each other to get the same client's needs met? You know, I'm ringing housing saying I've got a young person. They're pushing back at me saying that young person's in need. We're saying yes, but they still need a house. The police are pushing back at, you know, mental health. Mental health saying, well, they don't reach the you know, right criteria. Well, all of us, sometimes funding creates so many gates. And we're all talking about the same individual, the same person is there, but the different agencies are trying to push back. And I was working with a team the other day, an early help team, and they just, there's two parts of that team, and one works in the community and the other works in the referral place where they're distributed, where they're redistributing resources through a whole lot of agencies. And the people in the community think their job, they think they've succeeded when they've got the person in to that other team. Mm. And the other team think they've succeeded when they've kept the person out. And they were in the middle of this day talking to each other, and they suddenly realized that they were acting like football teams.
Mm. They were competing directly, yeah.
Yep. And they were really shocked. Mm. Like in themselves, they just stepped back and went, wow. You know, actually, our mantra is to keep referrals down and to push people back out to the community. And the community is all about trying to push them in.
And people do get stuck then, don't they?
Yep. Yeah. And that is all directly about having limited resources and seeing things as a competition instead of a collaboration. You know, but many of us work with the same families and the same people for a long time. Some of us only need time limited support, and some of us need lifetime support. Mm. And there's something about how we give people the help to get on with their lives in the way they choose.
So in an endeavor to sum that up, I suppose what I would say is,
good on you, Jerry.
Don't be frightened about money.
No.
It's at the heart of what we do. And think as broadly as we can about resource, and be really transparent about what the implications of the context are on people, what we're able to do, and try and work with other people as much as possible, other agencies, to create the right kind of support for someone, and thinking in the medium and long term, not just the kind of crisis. I think what you said about acknowledging that we can't do everything that we want to, and that we can carry some impact from that, is really important as well. So this is difficult work. So seeking support and having a kindness to ourselves about how difficult it is really, really crucial too. And I personally find it very helpful to do work outside of my day job to try to influence the context, because I feel like taking steps to influence policy or to influence public awareness of funding is quite therapeutic.
Mm. And critical, absolutely critical. And I guess the thing that I would just add there is, wherever possible, form collaborations wherever you can, because competition around funding in a resource poor area is not helpful. Actually, we need to be all the time thinking about collaboration.
Thank you so much, Jo. That's been really helpful.
Yes, well, I think that you've summed my ramblings up very nicely there, Jerry. So
we should have Lola back on next week.
We won't have Lola back on next week. She didn't behave herself as she promised me she would. I'm very disappointed.
I thought her contribution was very erudite.
Okay. Right.
Bye.
I'll talk to you next time. Bye.